Our third argument today is 02-00570A, Scott R. Jensen versus Wisconsin Elections Board. And I'll give you what I have as the lineup of the argument today. 25 minutes to Attorney Troupas, representing the petitioners Jensen and Panzer. 12 minutes to Attorney May, representing the intervener respondents Koala and Black. 13 minutes to Attorney Williamson, representing intervener respondents Sawiak. 5 minutes to Assistant Attorney General Thomas Balistrary, representing respondent Wisconsin Elections Board, and 5 minutes to Attorney Troupas in rebuttal. Is that your understanding? Okay, we might proceed. Mr. Troupas.
May it please the court, I am Jim Troupas of Michael Best and Friedrich, and with Patrick Hodan of Reinhardt, Warner, Van Duren, and others, we represent Scott Jensen, the Speaker of the Assembly, Senator Mary Panzer, Senate Minority Leader, and we request that the petition for leave to file an original action concerning legislative apportionment be granted. There are two primary elements today, the legal and the practical. From the legal side, the long history of granting the petitions, the obvious public importance, and the critical importance of federalism to the future of the state and nation. On the practical side, there is the reality of politics, the importance of process, and the necessity of time. I'll address each of those in sequence, but first, three salient facts. First of all, the population of the state has increased and changed in such a way in the 1990s that the present legislative apportionment is no longer consistent with Wisconsin's constitutional mandates of Article 1, Section 1, Article 4, Sections 3, 4, and 5. The legislature is at an impasse, and that thus will not satisfy Article 4, Section 3 of the Wisconsin Constitution's obligation to redistrict within the first session following the decennial census.
Mr. Troupas, why do you say that the legislature is at an impasse? What's causing an impasse?
As a legal matter, it is alleged in the petition, and thus it is assumed as true. As an answer directly to the question, the parties have been unable to reach agreement with regard to a legislative plan sufficient enough to introduce legislation on the floor of either house. Both Senator Koala and Speaker Jensen have alleged impasse in separate, distinct proceedings, but Senator Koala alleged impasse in the federal proceedings and indicated he did not see that this matter could be resolved, and he did that on December the 6th. 3 weeks later, or 4 weeks later, we are here because, in fact, with that filing by Senator Koala, it does take two, and the Speaker believes that we are at impasse if Senator Koala believes they're at impasse.
So, in other words, the bill couldn't be even introduced by either side? In other words, impasse means that there is, you're saying that there's just no way that any legislation could be introduced?
At this time. The practical fact of legislative process is oftentimes negotiations and the like will go on long before legislation is introduced. The introduction of legislation is in fact the last step in the process, not the first. And thus the WEAC petition, for example, that suggests simply because legislation hasn't been introduced, therefore the parties have not tried, is simply incorrect. The parties have tried. There is no point in introducing legislation which will just muddy the water. So legislative introduction is not necessary, and we are deep into the session, the last session when that could occur. The second salient fact that does not appear actually.
So just as a continuation of that, impasse does usually connote a beginning.
Yes.
And your point is taken that you don't need to mark the beginning by requiring legislation to be introduced. Is there anything that you can advance to support your contention that a beginning has been made?
Well, yes. In fact, the parties have met and discussed the matter and have been unable to reach agreement sufficient enough for the Speaker legislation. So they have met, the two parties have spoken, attempted to do that. We've also had, as the court is aware, congressional legislation, in fact, has gone forward. We've actually had hearings and proceeded on that account.
But you've engaged in negotiations, the parties have engaged in negotiations with one another on the issue of the legislative redistricting, that's what you're presenting.
Senator Kuala has approached the Speaker, and the Speaker has approached Senator Kuala, and they have spoken and been unable to reach even the most basic forms of agreement.
These are two reasonable guys. Why can't they reach agreement?
Historically, I can only say that even reasonable people may disagree so much.
I would note, I thought I had put the issue of redistricting behind me in 1990.
Yes, I do note that there are a number of members of the court who've been through these wars on both sides of the bench.
Mr. Troupas, let's assume for a minute that the court were to grant the petition for original action in this matter, and were to tell the legislature that it should get on with what's properly its business in the first instance, and were to set a deadline, what do you think might happen? Can you, I don't want you to speculate, but do you think that might break the impasse?
Oh, I think that if this court takes the matter and sets a schedule and moves forward, as with all litigation, the party's most greatest fear ultimately is that a resolution will be had that neither party would like. And so if, in fact, this court were to take schedule and move forward, that is, in fact, the single most powerful element in these parties reaching agreement. That's me speaking as a lawyer, having been in many courtrooms over the years. I think these parties are no different. Historically, that has happened.
Why counsel more powerful than a three-judge federal court?
Pardon me? Sorry, Your Honor.
Why more powerful than a three-judge federal court that has already agreed to take this, that already has, the parties have agreed on a scheduling order weekly, as I see this. You know what I'm referring to?
Yes.
Why would this court taking the case be more dramatic or important than the federal court taking it?
To begin with, if this court does not take this matter, the matter does not necessarily go back to the federal court. The second salient fact is that if this court denies the petition, it can be filed and may be filed in a circuit court, so that this court will hear it either on review or it will hear it today. Secondly, even the federal courts indicated that it prefers this court to take it. As a direct answer, I don't know that there is a significant difference on the basic question posed as to if one court has impact or another court has impact. I think the very fact that you're in litigation can push parties to try to reach some type of resolution.
So the circuit court, which should work as well as the Supreme Court.
I don't, I'm not sure that in a circuit court that would be the case, because they would then come to this court. That only this court is the final arbiter of state constitutional law and of this redistricting in state court.
Well, can't it be reviewed by a federal court?
No.
Our decision cannot be reviewed by a federal court?
It cannot be reviewed in the sense that this court would hear the matter initially. Once this court would rule on the matter, then it would have the imprimatur of this court. That court would not, for example, view it in the same sense as it's here today. That is to draw maps to indicate a remedy. The remedy could be reviewed under federal standards of Voter Rights Act or the like, but it would be, in no sense would it be similar to the review that this court would have at the outset.
That's right. But any court's decision here, if we take original jurisdiction, is reviewable by a federal court.
In that sense, yes. In that sense. I would point out, though, the third salient fact, which is that the federal court itself, which has taken the matter of legislative redistricting, has itself indicated deference to this court, has itself indicated in its most recent orders that it will not go forward with a trial at all if this court would rule on the matter. That is appropriate under concepts of federalism and concepts of the way we go forward.
I read the transcript that was provided to us, and the judge said he's not going to stay the proceedings. The proceedings are going to go forward.
Unless and until, on page 7 and 8, this court acts. That's correct.
That's right. And
well,
so
but he also said that this court had not acted, so that's why he's going. In other words,
as a predicate to the ruling, there was that. Also, simply going forward to trial would not issue an opinion. In fact, as happened in Minnesota and has happened elsewhere, if the state court were to take the matter, the practical matter in the federal court was, how much do we need to do so that we are prepared, should there nothing come from the state courts or state judiciary, to act in a timely fashion? So what it did by proceeding on a schedule was simply to concur with, I believe, the Groh decision. You defer, but we're prepared to act. And in fact, could go well through a trial, but still would not issue an opinion or a redistricting decision until and unless this court did not act.
Counsel,
and that's appropriate under federalism.
That transcript reads that the federal court is not staying its proceeding. And if this matter is to be stayed at all, it will only be if prior to the commencement of the trial on April 11th and 12th, on redistricting plans that for congressional districts and state legislative districts must be in place and fully implemented. So I read this as saying that the trial in federal court will go forward unless the regard to the legislative districts, something is in place and fully implemented. What do you understand the federal court to mean by fully implemented?
I don't know what the federal court meant.
What do you understand the federal court to mean by in place?
Oh, I think that it meant that there would be an order from this court indicating that, in fact, the following redistricting plan would be adopted.
So that's what in place means.
Yes.
So you have no idea what fully implemented means?
No, I don't, because there are a series of steps following an order, for example, in the Reynolds case or the like, where legislation and the like would follow. I mean, there are a series of steps in every court case where that follows. So that's why I hesitate on the question of implemented,
that
because it takes some time.
That concerns me in terms of the practicality of time limits, and that was the third thing that you mentioned, the practicality. Between now and the trial as scheduled in federal court, we have, I think, about 9 weeks. And if this court, and I need help with this, if this court is to take the kind of things set forth in your proposed scheduling order, issue a decision, write a decision, issue a decision, and have it fully implemented by April 11th, seems to me to be problematic.
Your Honor, why do I care? There'll be a trial on 11th and 12th of April. The decision will follow the first week of June, as it did the last time. If this court were to take this matter as it should, because the Wisconsin Constitution is at stake, because the provisions of this Constitution control, and because of the ruling in Groh and the federalism doctrines that this court itself would like adopted, then whether this court has its hearing in April or May, its decision must come on or before a time, as has been specified before. 3 to 4 months is the time frame we are dealing with here. That the parties will have to present evidence and otherwise proceed in the federal court is a logistical problem. Michael Beston Friedrich is plenty large enough as his board of ministers to carry on in two courts if that's what's necessary. But the issue is whether or not the state has an interest sufficient that it will proceed on its own. Second, as we are all aware, while the wording of Judge Clavert, sitting as he was, is what Your Honor has said, the fact of the matter is that if this court takes this matter and proceeds, comity would suggest that that court, the federal court, will do nothing to offend this court. If this court were to indicate it needed an extra week or two or a month, I don't believe that a federal district court would tell this court it will nonetheless issue a decision because Groh says not to do it. Defer to ongoing actions which are going on in the state court or the state judiciary. So there is, I don't think, any likelihood that the federal district court would issue a decision if this court had taken the matter, maps were being drawn, and they were going to be issued in a timely fashion by this court. To do otherwise would create a constitutional crisis contrary to Groh. And I don't think that court, because it specifically indicated as a predicate to what it said that this court had not acted, and as a further predicate that it would, in fact, even pull the trial, not the decision, but
can
even
I
the
just
trial.
Can I interrupt you a moment, Mr. Troupas? Let us just suppose that right here from the bench today we decide to take this case. Do you think there's going to be a status conference at the in Milwaukee in the federal court on February 8th at 10:30?
Yes.
And do you think that you will be sending in proposed plans, maps on February 13th?
February the 20th, actually.
Well, that's written, according to what I have, written discovery requests, but it's irrelevant.
That's right.
That the trial issue statement will be exchanged on March 8th in the federal
yes.
court. Everything is going to go right on, right? So what you're going to do is expend lawyer time, which requires funding, for this case in the federal court. And at the same time, I would expect that you will want a similar proposed schedule here.
Yes.
So I assume that you will want a status conference with the court. You would want to have initial witness lists. Is that right?
Yes.
Here?
Yes, I think.
And you will want written discovery requests
no,
here?
I do not think discovery is required at all.
Okay, but it's required in the federal court, but not
that,
here.
It certainly isn't required here. I mean,
but it is there. You want witness affidavits?
No.
Well, why do you think you need it in the federal court and you don't here?
Because the federal court is obligated to follow certain rules of civil procedure and thus has issues such as the Voting Rights Act and the like that it must address. The common procedure of the federal court requires them to make those kinds of findings and the like. This court, in contrast, doesn't have those obligations. As in the Reynolds case and in the Dreyfus case, this court in both instances required simply that briefs with submissions be made. Let me suggest a couple of others. In the Wisconsin statute 75109, of course, is the power to set up fact-finding. Under the stipulations that your honors entered in the pension case, for example, you used your inherent powers, not under 751, but your inherent power to order the parties to reach stipulation, and that will happen here. Nobody contests what the populations are. No one contests what the various ethnic ethnicity is. No one contests the borders of various Asian areas, and both sides agree there's an impasse. The only issue is whether what the remedy should be, and the inherent powers of this court to drive that stipulation, if you would like, to get to remedy could be done.
You don't think we need maps and witnesses as to what the remedy should be?
If there are maps and witnesses, I would suggest this court treat it as rulemaking. Similar to California and Minnesota, the Grohl case that your honors have in front of you, you are very familiar with the legislative process, the legislative due process, which this court itself uses in rulemaking. It could host post hearings. It could have maps submitted by various bodies through that rulemaking, and then recommendations could be made to the court and argued to the court without this court ever having to been involved in fact-finding or the like, but rather address the ultimate question of the maps. That kind of rulemaking goes on all the time with this court, and because this type of matter is almost identical, legislative in nature, that kind of rulemaking process would also work without the necessity of going through the ideas that the federal court has. The federal court doesn't have, it is uniquely unqualified to handle what is a legislative matter. It must handle it as strictly litigation, in which each party has a right to do A, B, C, and D. This court is not so bound. And when it comes to matters like this, as California has done, as Minnesota has done, as this court itself did in the Reynolds case, there are alternatives it can use that the federal court simply doesn't have at its behest. And that is the only way, ultimately, that this court can impose the kind of state constitutional standards on the process that are so important.
Mr. Troupas, doesn't the court, in effect, then have to decide what kind of rules it's going to follow in this kind of procedure? This is not our standard rulemaking procedure under 751, where we do practice pleading and procedure. So what we would have to develop is a whole process for handling this case. And do you have a process that you're going to suggest to the court? And a process that will be stipulated by both sides?
Well, once the other side has
been... When they haven't been able to agree on much else?
Once the other side has been told that this petition is granted and that this court is going to proceed, and it has requested the attorneys to provide an appropriate process for of the type I have just described, I have no doubt whatsoever that Mr. Williamson, Mr. May, and I would come to some understanding about that process. Because ultimately, we cannot avoid that someone is going to make a decision. And just as in the federal court, the parties ultimately agreed on that schedule, Your Honor is seeing, and on other orders, whether we liked to be there or not, once this court orders us to present this case in this court in an orderly fashion, counsel will, in fact, be able to come to those kind of conclusions, I have no doubt whatsoever.
Mr. Troupas, I want you to comment on my major concern, which is the institutional integrity of this court. A year ago, there was a huge partisan battle, of course, that we all recall. Every court that touched it got burned. They got burned because they lost a great deal of the public's perception of fairness and neutrality. I can imagine no issue more filled with partisanship at the state level than redistricting. Like I said, man, I was glad when I thought I'd gotten rid of it. As I see this case unfolding, the Democrats will put in their map to us. The Republicans will put in their map to us. One or the other might be chosen. Whoever loses is going to hurl the same invectives at this court as were hurled at the Florida courts and at the U.S. Supreme Court. And in my judgment, greatly damaged the integrity of the court system, getting involved with what is essentially a political battle. How do we avoid that if we take original jurisdiction?
Let me state at the outset that a court is going to take this case, whether it is the federal district court that will be the subject of the invective, or whether it is the state Supreme Court that will be the subject of the invective.
Better them than us.
The reason, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree is because what is at stake here is not simply the reapportionment of this state, but what is at stake is the Wisconsin Constitution. And sometimes provisions of that Constitution force this court into very, very difficult political matters. School funding, governmental vetoes, the school superintendent cases, the pension cases. One cannot avoid the fact that a court is going to have to rule on this. If this court defers to the federal district court to do so, it will have set a precedent that it is unable or unwilling to handle matters simply because it fears the kind of ridiculous invective that is posed in the halls of this Capitol time and time again. We are all conscious of that, and we are all embarrassed by it in the bar. And if this court must not, it cannot succumb to that kind of whispering campaign in the halls of the Capitol. If people want to say things, let them say it to this court in motions, let them approach it. But we don't avoid a hard problem because somebody is going to have to do this. Moreover, as a matter of law, Baker versus Carr and Reynolds versus Sims and the original Reynolds versus Zimmerman case here all acknowledge the very matter that Your Honor addressed, that these are political matters. And it's a darn shame that the legislative process cannot get there. But if there is to be a remedy, and there has to be, somebody must arbiter that. What better body than the members of this court who are elected from every corner of this state, who understand the communities they participate in, and who will do their very best to come to a solution that is impartial and that undertakes the constitutional provisions of our Constitution, compactness, contiguity, equal population, and the communities of interest, municipalities and counties. Those interests are stated in our Constitution as paramount. Only this court can see to it that those become the primary focus of these proceedings. It will be difficult. I don't deny that, but please do not succumb to that kind of whispering. It is wrong. It should never happen, and we and the members of Bar, it is our job to defend this process.
As I've thought over the past few days about ways to avoid damaging this institution, and I think they're very difficult, One process I thought of was having the Republicans name a master, the Democrats name a master, and between the two of them, they name a third, and then that panel of three gives us a plan. Would you find that acceptable?
I think that's a perfectly rational plan. I think that there are, that falls within the inherent powers of this court, as do some of the other rulemaking processes that I suggest. Because other interests, I would add one thing. As a practical matter, and this is the third time I have done redistricting, once in Illinois, twice here.
For you.
really, you thought you only legislators did this. As a practical matter, there will be other parties who will want to participate that are not here today. And so that the process would need to take that into account, that parties may submit things along the way. I only say that because the suggestion of one, two, and then a third. But in fact, I think that's a very rational way to approach the problem, because we have come here as the impartial body in to resolve this dispute.
What is the risk?
The removal has been raised.
I apologize.
The issue of removal has been raised in this case, and what occurs upon removal if there is a removal to the federal court. I know it would have to be litigated there.
But
do we have to wait until that occurs if we accept the case?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the first thing.
If the case is removed to federal court, if we accept, if we take the case,
yes.
One of the respondents files removal, removes it to federal court, it gets litigated there. Ordinarily, in a removal situation, the court of origin has to wait.
That suggestion of removal is in a footnote for a good reason. It's not going to happen. And the reason it can't happen is because the State Board of Elections, a party here, and cannot consent to the removal because its board has voted that this court is the appropriate jurisdiction under Rule 1441A. All parties must consent to that kind of removal. Second, I think Grohl would stand in the way of removal as well. I think that because they are commanded under Grohl to defer, it would trump the removal statute in any event. It will defer to the state judiciary under those circumstances. Finally, the issues, the federal issues, Voting Rights Act, Equal Protection under the 14th Amendment, are all matters that can be heard here and can be solved here as well as in the federal court. So there's no distinct item that could be removed into that court. So I don't think that there's any basis to expect such a removal would occur. And if there was such a move, it would certainly be ruled on very rapidly.
Mr. Troopas, I have two questions. One, why can't it be said that your clients have waived coming into this court, since this case is at least almost a year old, I understand, and yet it takes until January of this year for your clients to come here?
We did attempt to address that in the briefs, and I apologize if not clearly. In the February of last year, a congressional reapportionment case was filed. At that time, two parties intervened. We intervened. Senator Qualley intervened. Senator Qualley intervened by filing a request to bring state legislative districts into it. At the time, the court asked for comments from the parties. We were not a party, but did ask the interveners to address other issues. We addressed the other issues. It was not until November the 28th of this year that the ruling came down from the federal district court indicating that they would, A, allow that case to proceed on congressional, and B, allow the interveners to file the complaint. They could or could not. They decided on December the 6th to file that complaint. At that time, even then, we were not in the proceedings for purposes of that complaint. So we did not answer or otherwise plead to that complaint at all. We did, however, on three separate occasions, going back to February, indicate to the court that we believed that the state judiciary was the more appropriate forum.
You're only there for a limited purpose.
That's correct.
Because I'm going to ask the other people at the table if they're in here for a limited purpose, too.
Okay. And on December the 7th, we did, in fact, indicate before the very first hearing, and we filed appropriately that, so we did not want to mislead that court.
So it took you about 6 weeks to get here. Is that your position?
Yes.
Okay.
32 days.
32 yes. days. I have another question. Since your position is that this court is going to have to make up its rules as it goes along, since it doesn't have past experience, except maybe, 40 years old, roughly, in this area, and you're suggesting that we do it by rulemaking, In a law review article cited by, I guess it was the federal court, it was suggested that the federal court and state courts ought to combine forces and work together. So you don't have a situation of having a trial schedule in a federal court and a different kind of trial schedule here. And that's not unheard of. It's been done in mass tort cases, et cetera. What's your position on that?
First of all, I'm unfamiliar with the article, but the principle that I think I tried to say that a little bit earlier, though, obtusely, which is even though the words of this transcript say one thing, the practical fact is the federal court is busy enough, as is this court, and would not want to duplicate effort or undertake efforts that are unnecessary.
So without joining, would you agree to that?
We certainly would agree to consultation between the two courts.
Oh, working together, hand in hand, glove in glove.
That I don't know, because it implicates issues, legal issues concerning the standards that would be applied in any given proceeding. And so I do not have an opinion with regard to that. With regard to coordination of scheduling, I cannot see how that would implicate any of the legal issues of federalism and the like that I think are critical here.
Okay, counsel, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. May, Attorney May.
Your Honors, I'm Michael May of the Boardman Law Firm, and I appear today on behalf of intervener respondents Charles Qual and Spencer Black. May it please the Court. We urge this court not to take original jurisdiction in this case. This is a case where the federal court has jurisdiction. It can timely issue the very remedies that the petitioners have come to this court to seek. I plan to touch here today on four important reasons that this court should not accept the petition. Those reasons are, first, this court is not a trial court, and a trial has to be held to hear the important claims in this case. Second, unlike prior reapportionment cases in this court, the federal court now has complete and original jurisdiction. It can provide a full and timely remedy. This fact alone defeats the request for original jurisdiction. Third, it will be very difficult, as the court has noted, for this court to provide a timely remedy unless it gives short shrift to the rights of the parties. We strongly disagree about the possibility of some sort of rulemaking. There are fundamental rights at stake here, due process rights of the parties that require a trial. Fourth, judicial efficiency and efficiency of state resources counsels this court to have one judicial forum to hear matters related to both congressional and legislative redistricting, if that should be necessary. Before I get into expanding on those four points, I want to respond to a couple of items Mr. Troupas raised in his argument, a couple of matters on which I disagree. I'm not certain we are at an impasse. My understanding from talking to my client is they've approached Mr. Troupas' client and were basically told, we're not interested in talking about redistricting. Now, if we remain in that situation, then obviously we do have an impasse because it does take two. It's our intention to introduce some legislation between now and the end of the session. Hopefully we can get that through the Senate. Where it will go from there, we don't know. But that's the intention of our client. I think that if this court grants the petition, the likelihood of an agreement will go down. And I think the pressure on the parties from the federal court is sufficient that if we're going to negotiate something, we will do it. The second thing is that I disagree that the federal court will step aside. I think Judge Clavert has made it very clear. He has set this deadline. If he doesn't have a plan sitting in front of him that has been agreed to or implemented either by this court or the state legislature and signed by the governor on April 11th, we're having a trial. And he's going to go ahead with the trial, and he will proceed to issue an order following the trial.
Counsel, I want to touch upon that because I asked Mr. Troupas about that. And as I read the transcript, the federal court judge said not once, but the next page twice, and I think very strong words, that and anything, the second time he says, and anything that takes place prior to scheduled trial will not cause this court to throw off the trial unless there are, in fact, in place provisions already set. So it's not just a parenthetical expression, but twice he says it. Mr. Troupas's response, and I very much respect the response because he's had a lot of experience, and in essence, he's saying to me, Judge, but that's not the way it's going to happen. And you're telling me, Judge, that is the way it's going to happen. So there must be something that one of us doesn't understand.
I take Judge Clifford at his word. He said that. He meant it twice in the transcript. Second, he's following the exact procedure that the Supreme Court told courts to follow in Grow. The federal court gets the case, it sets a date by which it says to the state, legislature, courts, whomever, here's the date. If you come up with a plan by that date, fine, we're back off. This is the deference that the Supreme Court talks about.
Mr. Troupas's response with regard to the Grow case and to comity is very persuasive. Grow case and comity might suggest the federal court would do something different than it said.
Well, Judge Clivert may change his mind. I think he was very clear in these hearings. He set that date. He has said to us, we're going to have a trial on that date, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, unless you come in here and somebody can show me that a plan has been either enacted by the legislature and signed by the governor, or otherwise that a court has undertaken. Might he change his mind? I suppose, but I don't. I think he's adopted the procedure in Grow, and he's going to go ahead on that basis.
But would the federal court be at liberty to disregard a plan adopted by this court as the law of this state?
If this court were to adopt a plan prior to the court issuing a plan?
Well, even afterwards. Let's say we take the case, we go ahead and go about our business of ignoring a plan, and don't meet Judge Gilbert's deadline.
And
he goes ahead with the trial. Even if we were to adopt a plan in May, would the federal court be at liberty under Brow to disregard that? Doesn't it become a law of this state and tied to the deference of the federal court?
So you're positing a situation where the federal court would have the trial, they would issue a plan, and subsequently this court, or?
Yeah.
I'm not sure where we would be then. We'd have two judgments, one from a federal court saying these are the districts, and unless this court's at the exact same districts, you would have two separate judgments in terms of what the plan would be. I'm not certain then where we'd be in that situation.
But I think you both would.
Pardon me?
They might both be there.
I can tell you this, the elections board would be in a lot of trouble trying to figure out how they're supposed to conduct an election.
Doesn't Brow stand for the proposition that in that scenario, the federal court cannot substitute its plan, or the state court's plan has to give presumptive authority to the state court's plan unless there's some sort of voting rights violation?
I think that if this state court, any state court or the state legislature were to issue a plan before the federal court did, that the federal court would at that point not issue a plan. I'm not certain once they've issued a plan whether they would then issue a subsequent order and say, now that the state court has acted, we will step aside.
Have problems about full faith and credit.
Yes.
And you also have the issue that the plan is subject to, a state Supreme Court plan is subject to collateral attack.
Yes.
If this
court adopts a plan or the legislature adopts a plan, someone can bring an action in federal court challenging that.
So right now what we're really talking about is which branch of the state government is going to write the plan, which will later be subject to challenge in federal court.
Well, it will be, if the legislature adopts a plan, obviously the challenge is much bigger court. If this court adopts a plan, I don't know whether it will be challenged in federal court.
And it need to be challenged by other parties. They're not.
Could be challenged by people who are not before this court. Could be challenged by any voter who has the right to bring in a case.
Or it can go right up to the United States Supreme Court.
Well, I think they'd have to bring it in district court first. But a three-judge panel decision is directly appealable to the Supreme Court.
What is the nature of congressional reapportionment in the legislature? Is there any impacts there or not?
There's been a plan introduced and passed the Assembly. It's going to be before the Senate. My understanding is the Senate intends to, at some point, take it up whether they will pass that plan, a different plan, amend it, or not pass a plan, I'm not certain, but I'm advised they intend to, at least attempt to deal with that plan again before this session is over. Again, whether they're successful or not.
What is the status of the original plaintiffs in federal court? Would they want to participate in state legislative?
I'll defer that to Mr. Williamson, who represents those plaintiffs. He'll probably speak better than what they're going to do in both in that court and
this court. Mr. Manning, from a public policy concern, looking at there, what would be your strongest argument against this court getting involved at all?
Well, I think there are two strong arguments in terms of public policy. First is, this court's an appellate court. It's not a trial court. And there are a number of facts that will be in dispute and are going to have to be determined one way or another, and that simply is not the institutional basis of what this court is.
Mr. Mayor, why couldn't we handle that just like we did the pension case? What's the great distinction between the two that you say?
Well, I think the great distinction is that there are a number of facts that we will not be able to stipulate.
For instance.
Well, some of the facts I think that we'll have difficulty stipulating too are whether certain districts that are drawn within the city of Milwaukee comply with the Voting Rights Act. Do they individuals? I don't think it is, because I think there are underlying questions of fact relating to the nature of the population, whether in fact you have a population there that votes in minority blocks, does not vote in minority blocks, et cetera. Second question of fact that I think you'll actually...
Do you need expert witnesses on that?
Yes, we do. And we intend to bring, I believe the other side will, in federal court. We also will have expert witnesses on questions of compactness and continuity. There are rather sophisticated tests that experts apply to which sort of map has greater compactness, less compactness, and whether there are issues of continuity.
And why couldn't we appoint a referee to make those factual determinations, or handle it just like we did in the pension case with the reserve judge assigned to determine any factual disputes?
The court has that authority. I think that if you're going to try the case, the court would either have to refer it to a trial court here in Dane County, presumably, or appoint a referee to actually hear the trial. But by the time you get done hearing that trial or finding the fact, I'm assuming we're going to be upon the trial in Milwaukee, and we're going to have two sets of lawyers running back and forth between two courts, getting ready to try the same case in two different courts. And it just doesn't make sense to me to be wasting that inefficient use of both state's resources and the lawyers, who a number of whom are being paid for with the taxpayers' funds in this case. But I think my second argument that I didn't get to is that because the federal court has power to hear this, we are in a very different situation than this court has ever been in before. When this court previously heard reapportionment cases, it took them up because nobody else could handle them. And that's why this court has not redrawn districts in this state since 1964, when you had Baker against Carr and when you had Reynolds against Sims. And if you look at the original jurisdiction, this court says, one of the things it looks to is, do you have a remedy elsewhere? Or is this a matter that if we don't step in, nothing's going to happen? If you go back to the Cunningham case, the court says, when it first looked at reapportionment in this state in the 1890s, if there's no remedy here, there's no remedy anywhere. We have to take it. That is no longer the case. Times have changed. Law has changed.
This court agreed to take a reapportionment case in the 80s, however.
You took it and it went to federal court thereafter. Yeah. So I agree with the point made by Mr. Troupas that this court at one point accepted a petition. It was then removed. But you have not drawn districts since 1960. And we think this court can't go back to a 1960-style rulemaking when you're talking about fundamental rights of the parties to have a right to a trial on these issues.
I have two questions for Mr. Mann. One, somebody in a brief suggested that we use the Legislative Reference Bureau, as they've been done before, and just have them draw districts.
Well, I certainly wouldn't have suggested that. What may have been suggested is to utilize the Legislative Reference Bureau as a technical assistant to any court that is going to take this up. And in fact, we are discussing with the federal court right now the court's ability to utilize some of the state personnel who have expertise with computers, who have expertise with the drawing of maps, that they would provide assistance to the court, set up the court's computers so that they could examine and look at these maps and provide that kind of specialized assistance that most courts, including, I suspect, this court probably doesn't have on staff. So again, because you're talking about a cause of action based on equal protection of the laws in terms of reapportionment, I don't think it's a situation where somebody behind the scenes, when they're not subject to trial rights, can simply draw them in.
My second question is, since one of the issues here is two courts proceeding along the same line, hearing similar kind of evidence, witnesses twice coming. Sorry, we are having trouble with our sound system. It's been suggested in other areas and in this one that the state and federal will work together. If the two courts can agree and if all the parties can agree, what's your position on that?
I hadn't thought about it before today, but I'd be interested in exploring that. I think one of the difficulties in trying to do that, of getting the three-judge panel from Milwaukee together along with seven justices here, is going to be the timing and the ability, again, to reach a timely remedy that the elections board needs to go ahead with elections. If those could be worked out, the parties could agree on a procedure, I'd be intrigued by that possibility to see if that could work.
Thank you, Mr. May.
Mr.
Wilkerson.
Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Brady Williamson with LaFollette Godfrey and Kahn, and we represent the Wisconsin Education Council and its members. This board on January 18th permitted us to intervene as respondents. We oppose the petition. The teachers of this state do not have a vote in the legislature, but like every citizen, they do have a very real interest in the outcome of this proceeding and in the legislative redistricting process. PAC and its members are the only parties in this proceeding that do not hold public office. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters because legislative redistricting is not a duel between competing political parties or between competing houses of the legislature. The legislature, both parties and both houses are litigants here, and no one would argue they shouldn't be. The legislative districting process, whenever and wherever it ends, will directly influence which party controls the state assembly and which party controls the state senate. But control should be neither the goal of the process nor the measure of its success. Balanced representative government should be. At stake, after all, is the public policy of this state for the next 10 years. And in that regard, we suggest the legislative leadership has been a disappointment. They have, we believed, asked too little of themselves, and now they ask too much of this court. Justice Sykes asked, isn't this all about which branch of state government is most appropriate for drawing legislative districts? And that's certainly one of the key questions. But there's no doubt about the answer. The legislative branch is the branch most appropriate to decide legislative districting, and that's been the law of the state for 150 years.
In fact, I think we all agree. I agree on that. But based on what other counsel have indicated, although a bill may be introduced, is a question I asked, is that realistic, that the legislature is going to get involved?
It ought to be, Justice
yes.
Wilcox.
Oh, I agree with you.
There's certainly enough time, and there's certainly enough will, and to use Justice Babbage's phrase, these are reasonable guys and women, able to deal with sophisticated, difficult political issues. Justice Bradley,
Mr. Williamson, when was the last time that the legislature agreed on legislative districts?
1972.
I served on that one.
That must be why they agreed.
Justice Bradley suggested a focus here for the moment on the judicial schedules and what's the federal court doing, what have the parties stipulated to, what could this court do in the same equivalent time frame. But Justice Bradley, the focus ought to be on the legislative schedule. There's not a shred of evidence, not a shred of evidence on the record that any effort has been made. There's no impasse. There can't be an impasse until there's an effort. There can't be failure until there's an effort. Not a single bill has been introduced in either the Senate or the Assembly. Not a single substantive hearing has been held. Not a single word of debate in either chamber. And it is surely, surely, not because the legislative leadership hasn't given this some thought. To the contrary, in the year since the census data have been available, the legislative leadership, both parties, both houses, have had the opportunity and motive, to borrow a phrase, not to mention the incentive and the ability to carefully develop districting plans. But they haven't exchanged them. At least there's no evidence of that. And there is evidence. The public has not seen them. There is no evidence that there has been a genuine good faith effort to have this matter solved by the single body charged by the Constitution with solving it.
Mr. Williamson, in your brief, you suggest that we ought to tell the legislature to do its business, to get on with redistricting. Doesn't that have a lot more impact if we take the case and then we tell them to do that and set a deadline for them to reply?
No, Your Honor. To the contrary. I think if this court accepts this case as a matter of original jurisdiction, whatever hope there was that the legislative process, by the way, this is a small d democratic process, that the legislative process will work, will evaporate. There won't be a chance, a snowball's chance in the state capitol of that happening.
Just to follow up on that, because that was the question one of my colleagues asked, if we took the case and then sat on it and directed or gave the legislature the opportunity that you're indicating that they should have, wouldn't that act as, quote, an incentive for them to get the business done as you suggest?
Justice Wilcox, the federal court has already imposed a deadline, and there's no evidence that that has had an effect here. I don't know that another deadline by this court would change anything. I've always felt that one of the precepts of being a judge, looked at from the other side of the bench, is you don't make decisions until you have to make decisions. And I don't think this process has been given the opportunity to work. I mean, congressional districting was introduced in the Assembly, and within 3.5 weeks it was passed. Now, do we know what's going to happen in the Senate? No. But if the federal court, in the final analysis, has to decide congressional districting because there really is an impasse, you know what? It will have a bill passed by the Assembly by a vote of 78 to 21 to be precise. And it can make of that proposal whatever it wishes. In 1964, which was the last time this court visited state legislative districting, it had a dozen proposals already in front of it. But in the 40 years since 1964, there's been a revolution in the law of districting, and there's been a revolution in the practical logistics and politics of redistricting. Computer technology now is such that with the press of a button, you can scramble districts all over the state. And that's both a blessing, members of the court, but it is also a curse. Because the parties that will come to you with plans, and there will be a number of them, they're all going to have zero deviation. That is to say, the parties will come to you with districts, 33 is Senate, 99 Assembly, in which the deviation from the ideal norm will be zero. But some of those plans will be anything but perfect. because it is now possible to create perfect districts, each with the same number of people, with widely disparate political results. And we've talked here a bit about referees, about rulemaking, but how are you going to evaluate those plans? All of them will be perfect. All of them will have zero deviation. But there'll probably be a plan that guarantees that the current leadership of the Senate will stay that way for the next 10 years, and probably there'll be a plan that guarantees that the current leadership of the Assembly will stay that way for 10 years. I mean, this state has political balance, whether it's 51% one party, 49% the other. But it is possible with computer technology to draw legislative districts that create massive majorities for one party in one body and for another party in the other body. And so how do you judge that? Well, in 1992, Judge Crabb in the Federal District Court, her two colleagues, heard two full days of testimony. And most of that testimony was focused on how do you judge the political fairness of a plan? How would we judge the political fairness of the plans that come before you in 2002? Would we use the presidential election, in which 5,000 votes out of 2.7 million cast decided the outcome? Or would we use the remarkable record of Governor Thompson over 16 years, or the equal remarkable electoral record of Senator Cole? How are you going to measure the impact of these proposals?
Ms. Williamson, could you address yourself just for a moment to the timeliness matter? The Elections Board has suggested that we should have a map in place by May 1st, that it's necessary. What's your feeling on that?
I think that's an accurate assessment of what's needed, Your Honor. Chapter 10.72, I believe, provides that the first notices that go out from the Election Board must be mailed by May 15th. Again,
it was so difficult to determine the fairness, and from what I have read, it is. Then why is a federal court any better than this court, or vice versa?
I don't think there's any suggestion that either the federal court is the best or that this court is the best. The federal court happens to have, at the moment, several advantages. It has a stipulated trial schedule in place. The federal court, for better or for worse, has done legislative redistricting in this state for each of the last two decades, and the parties are preparing for trial. On the subject of trial, Chief Justice, I don't think we can simply say, oh, let's have a referee do it, or let's treat it as an administrative hearing. There really are fundamental rights at issue, and even if there weren't, you, the triers of fact and law, need evidentiary tools to make these judgments. There was some discussion about a stipulation. Well, first of all, forgive me for noting that if the legislative leadership can't even agree on a bill to introduce, how is their counsel going to agree on a stipulation of facts as this court had to work with in the pension case, for example? How could the parties do that? Two federal district courts in the last 6 months have decided that the Census Bureau must release not just the actual enumeration, which has been released, but the statistical adjustment of the actual enumeration. You're going to have to decide which set of statistics to use, which set of data, the actual enumeration that took place in the census, or the adjustment that has not yet been released, but has been ordered to be released by the Commerce Department. There's a factual issue that will need to be decided, and you'll need expert testimony on it. Could this court do it? Of course this court could do it. This is not a question of authority, power. It's a question of discretion. It's a question of what is best for this institution. Justice Bablish made some observations on that point. And what is best for the state as the whole. And I don't think there's any doubt that the legislature owes it to you and owes it to the people of the state to make an effort. Again, in 1964, the legislature passed several redistricting plans. The governor vetoed them. That's fine. That's the way the process works. But at least there, the court in 1964 had two plans adopted by majorities in each house of the legislature. That wasn't the law, but at least there was an indication of public and political support, and at least there had been the democratic process at work, hearings, debate. We ask that the court deny this petition. We ask that the court ask the legislature, direct the legislature, to turn its attention to the assignment it was given more than 150 years ago. Apportion and district anew the members of the Senate and the Assembly according to the number of inhabitants. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Yes, granted.
Sometimes as a mother, I wrestle with the problem of how to make kids do their homework when there's no will to do it. You're asking this court to essentially have the legislature do their homework when there doesn't appear to be at least a will to get together and put something on the table. Why is your exhortation that we have the legislature do it going to be any more successful than me having someone do homework when it's not within their will?
Because this court has moral force, because what this court says has political force, not in the partisan sense, but in the sense of this court being the ultimate arbiter of how this state government works and how it ought to work. Justice Bradley, you're absolutely correct. You can't make children play together nicely in the sandbox if they don't want to. But you can say that we are not about to take a case when there is no evidence of an impasse and there is no evidence that the one branch most able to do the job has made the slightest attempt to do so. And that's why I think just as this court has given the legislature directives in the area of education, setting broad standards, just as this court has given the legislature directive in a variety of areas, that the court ought to say what the Constitution means. And what it means is the legislature should reapportion the state.
But failing that, some agency, some branch of state government has to do it. The courts are the only other branch that can do it. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the federal courts should defer to state courts as well as state legislatures in this area. So couldn't it be argued that we have an institutional obligation to take the case under these circumstances?
No. Because whatever your institutional obligation might be, Justice Sykes, it has to be tempered with a practical awareness of the difficulties of trying cases. It has to be done with a practical awareness of your docket. I noticed the court took 11 cases yesterday. This is not like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. This is very difficult stuff. And it was difficult enough, as three of you know, on the floor of the legislature. In a judicial setting, it is even more difficult.
Could I ask Mr. Williamson, some might say that this all was an exercise in forum shopping. If the court, this court, doesn't take jurisdiction, won't we be rewarding victory to the first people who file?
Sometimes, Your Honor, filing first does matter. Here, of course, it was not just a question of filing first. It was having filed a year ago and having all of this time pass, having had hearings in front of the three-judge panel in the form of Judge Clavert, having had that court on November 28th decide some very important issues of standing and rightness. It's not just who beat whom to the courthouse and which courthouse. There's no question that this court, Justice Sykes, has an institutional interest in redistricting in the state constitution, but the federal district court doesn't have any less. The 14th Amendment, Reynolds versus Sims, 2 years after Baker's versus Carr, was specifically used to ensure that state legislatures were fairly apportioned.
But the Grau decision establishes a different sort of a hierarchy than existed the last time this court was involved in a redistricting matter, doesn't it, as a matter of federalism? I mean, you mentioned a revolution in the law of redistricting. There's been sort of a little mini revolution in the law of federalism that establishes a different hierarchy and says that state courts are primary rather than secondary.
I certainly agree the state court is not secondary. I would state that the legislature is primary, and that the two court system, federal and state, have equal interest. And whether one, this is not a game of judicial chicken, whether one court begins first and the other tries to catch up shouldn't be the goal here. The goal here is to get a plan in place so that the state can conduct elections in September and November of 2002 in an orderly fashion.
Now, as I read the Grow case, and as I have read other cases interpreting the Grow case and commentators interpreting the Grow case, it's quite clear in Grow the state court started first. Parties then went to the federal court. United States Supreme Court said, not that you that the federal court had to get rid of the case or throw it out of federal court, but that the federal court ought to wait. And that the federal court can direct that unless things were done within a certain time period, the federal court would continue its proceedings. I've seen language in briefs and in the cases that say that that means the federal courts have priority over the states. But as interpreted by several other cases and the commentators, doesn't mean that at all. It means that the federal court has jurisdiction, and if it gets jurisdiction first, it can do exactly what Judge Clavert did. And that, it seems to me, was his interpretation of the Grow case. So I'm concerned that the Grow case not be cited to mean state courts have priority, because I don't think that's what it necessarily says. Now, since I have stated a position you probably will agree with, I'm doing it to the wrong party. So when Mr. Troopas comes here, I mean, I let it go the first time in the argument, and I let it go in a variety of times, but time to clear the air on that, but I'm going to ask you the same questions I've asked other people. And in light of Justice Prosser's statement about forum shopping, and when you're reading up of this literature by scholars, they say that the parties select the forum in which they think they might do better. I mean, that's standard operating procedure for lawyers, right? Sometimes they guess wrong, but that's it. But in light of the fact that A might take one court to get a, hoping they'll get a particular result, and B will come to another court hoping that it will get a result, and both hope that the legislature will see, well, if A court takes jurisdiction, party C is going to get a better deal. And if B court takes jurisdiction, party Y is going to get a better deal. And that these are used as bargaining chips. That's what the literature says. I don't know. I've never been involved. Thank the Lord. Okay. Never been involved in it. So if that's the game plan, which I don't expect you or anyone else to agree to as the game plan, that's why I keep asking everybody, okay, this court has no process. Why don't we get together with the feds if we decide to take it and not take it unless we can get together so we have a neutral ground?
First, Chief, I wouldn't change a word of your analysis of Grove versus Emerson.
What a surprise.
Secondly, the Harvard Law Review article to
that's
which
the one I'm referring to, and I read the cases cited therein.
you know, the Harvard Law Review article, I think, simply states the obvious, which is that particularly in a political case, that's what redistricting is, that parties are going to take whatever procedural steps they think will enhance their position. I think that's a given. And when you have a jurisprudence, the jurisprudence of redistricting, that I think fairly stated says that both the federal system and the state system have jurisdiction and authority equally, I think it's perfectly natural. And then, Justice Prosser, considerations of who filed first and how far along the process is, I think, become fairly significant. But, you know, I on behalf of the teachers' union, I find it not awkward, but interesting that we're the party that's saying to the other parties, you have the solution in your hand, you have the remedy. The teachers' union can't vote on a plan of redistricting, but the legislative leadership here can. And I think this court should not underestimate its own moral suasion and its own ability to make a difference here by suggesting that the parties read the state constitution. Thank you.
Chief, I just have one quick technical question, and this won't take long. For a period of time, it looked like the three-judge panel was a two-judge panel, and then I saw that the transcript that you submitted at the last status conference referenced a consultation with Judge Easterbrook's schedule, and so I assume that problem no longer exists.
It appears that the three-judge panel will be a three-judge panel with Judge Easterbrook present and speaking as a lawyer who will appear in front of that panel one way or the other. I think that'll make it an interesting experience.
Mr. Williamson, I have one last question, and that is, what is your comment on removal?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What is your comment on removal?
In 1982-83, the governor, Lee Sherman Dreyfus, filed a petition with this court. The petition was granted. The matter was removed to federal district court in Madison, as Section 1441 requires. It was then transferred to federal district court in Milwaukee, where a case was already underway and then consolidated. I think it's an open question about whether unanimity among all the respondents is required, but in any event, as I think either Justice Crooks or Justice Sykes mentioned, the federal court will decide that. It's also interesting that whatever this court decides, it may be appealable directly to the U.S. Supreme Court, as this court's decisions usually are, but I also think it's appealable, and I put that in quotes, to the three-judge panel, not just on the Voting Rights Act, but on the whole range of issues that this court decides. So, Justice Prosser, whether or not there is literal removal, there is a process to go from this court, whatever its decision, to a three-judge panel, which I think raises the question of why should you undertake the effort if that will be one of the results.
I see no other questions. Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Assistant Attorney General Ballester.
Some of my colleagues, Your Honor, have it easy because they represent either Republicans or Democrats. I represent four Republicans, three Democrats, and one court-appointed member of the Elections Board. So our position has to be a little bit different than the positions that you've heard espoused by those who have gone before me today. We have to take a very practical position on this. And that practical position is that we need a redistricting plan that will be constitutionally acceptable, decided on, and ready to be implemented in time to have a practical effect on the upcoming fall elections. As I indicated in my response, the Elections Board thinks that a target date of May 1st is the date that we ought to have a redistricting plan decided on in order to have a practical effect on the elections. We have already been litigating this case in federal court. We've had a number of hearings on that case already. We have a litigation plan that has been decided upon by the parties, and we have a trial date set in the middle of April. So there is every reason to think that if this case proceeds in the federal court, we can have a redistricting plan decided upon by the federal court in place by May 1st. There's, of course, no guarantee of the May 1st date, but it certainly is a possibility. In this court, we don't even have a plan of proceeding. We have no rules governing how this case should be litigated. Should it go to a master? Should it go to a panel of masters? Should this court sit as a seven-member fact-finding body, which in my judgment it could under its plenary grant of original jurisdiction?
None of that seems to bother your client, Mr. Ballester. Your client wants us to take the case.
The client wants a speedy resolution. That's what the client wants.
And the client doesn't seem to think that we can't do that.
There are some serious questions. We're not saying that you can't do that. What we're saying is there's some very serious question whether you can do that in a timely fashion. And my position today is to simply urge you to make a conscientious determination whether you think you can come up with a redistricting plan by May 1st or sometime very soon afterwards. And if you do not think that you can do that with all of the problems that have been presented to you, and I think resolution of factual issues is one of those problems. There has to be expert testimony. There's going to be expert testimony in the federal court. There's going to be probably competing plans presented. There's going to have to be some kind of a factual resolution. Seven members of this court are going to have to make a decision on which plan they think is okay, if they think any plans are okay that have been presented to them. I urge you to make a very conscientious decision, and if you think that you cannot come up with a redistricting plan in time to have a practical effect on the election, that you simply allow the federal court, which is poised to do that, to just carry on and allow them to do its work. All right. Those are all the comments I have. Thank you.
Why do you say May 1st is the deadline?
We cite May 1st because there's a whole chain of events that have to take place in order for the election to take place. The critical event for the board is that the board has to certify the election districts to the counties by May 14th, which means that the board has to tell the counties, here, counties, these are the lines in which you are going to be conducting your district, your elections.
Has the Eastern District of Wisconsin ever reapportioned the state before?
Yes.
When was that?
Yes, it has. I believe in the 92 elections.
1982.
82. Do you think they did it by May 1st?
I don't know what the date was.
It wasn't until well into June. So the track record for the Eastern District would be that they've been late 100% of the time.
Well, I think the track record is a little different. You have a different Olympiad here with different participants.
Isn't the track record also that the legislature changed the plan of the federal court in Milwaukee after 1982?
The legislature can certainly change the plan if it wants to. That is their prerogative.
I have some personal experience with that plan in 82 because I couldn't even circulate my own nomination papers, having to get up and move. And I draw the inference that the federal court didn't do a particularly good job at being sensitive to some of the political factors.
I don't think we have any reason to think that this particular panel will be insensitive. We have some litigators in this case who are extremely competent, who have experience, and I think that they're fully capable of bringing all these political factors to the attention of the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ballester. Mr. Troupas.
admonished last year by a federal district court judge in California that it is good to answer the judge's question. So, Justice Abramson, let me address the comment that you directed to me a moment ago. With all due respect, I disagree with the conclusion of the Harvard Law Review article, and let me tell you why. If the conclusion is as you said.
Well, there were cases that so indicate, too. Judge Clavert so indicated.
I don't believe that he did. In fact, on the top of page 8 of the transcript, he specifically indicates, and I quote, in light of that decision, this court will not set a date by which either the legislature or any other Wisconsin authority must act. He has not set a date for this court to act, nor would he do so. He has simply indicated that a trial could proceed, as I indicated it would, because it cannot know today, or as a predicate to his comment on the prior page, it could not know then whether this court would take it and the procedures that follow. Second, on the decision itself, on Groh, and I will quote Groh, page 34, it says, on the question of whether federal courts need to defer to states, what is the hierarchy, state or federal? Quote, today we renew our adherence to the principles expressed in Germano, which derive from the recognition that the Constitution leaves with states primary responsibility for apportionment of their federal, congressional, and state legislative districts. I quote further on that same page. And in the injunction itself treated the state's court's provisional legislative redistricting plan as, quote, interfering in the reapportionment process. But the doctrine of Germano prefers both state branches to the federal court as agents of reapportionment. I think that Judge Scalia would find it unacceptable that unanimous decision that he wrote, that in fact was meant to say somehow that simply the who got there first controls. Third, the court itself indicates that state courts and state legislatures are to be treated the same for purposes of the principles of that case. Yet surely the state legislature can't be trumped because it did or did not do it. As Justice Prosser pointed out a moment ago, the state legislature can enact something anytime it wants and trump the federal court and trump this court as well. So if, in fact, as that court did in Germano, tie them both together to be on the same principle, then the hierarchy is they must defer to the state court. Fourth, on the question of federalism, and it is a question on which I feel passionately, and it would be contrary to Professor Tribe and others at Harvard, but it is that this court, the principle of federalism, is important to the state of Wisconsin like no other state in the Union. Because as a progressive state, we want the power, in some instances, to be more emphatic about the rights that we have for our citizens. On others, perhaps less. But in either instance, the federal government ought not trump what this state does. And that is the most fundamental principle of federalism. And I think that Germano and Groh are simply two cases in that line which ended several years, which is now going on in the Supreme Court, which suggests that they defer to states. Lastly, and most importantly, our state constitution has specific provisions dealing with apportionment. Article 4, Section 3, Article 4, Section 4, Article 4, Section 5. They lay out objective criteria that will be applied in apportionment. If you apply those objective criteria, my firm belief is you will meet all of the objections that might be. You will have equal population. You will have addressed communities of interest, whether those communities of interest are the ethnic or racial mix of Milwaukee, or whether they are the differences between Racine and Kenosha. So I think this court, or whatever body this court might designate for purposes of fact-finding to the extent it's necessary, and I don't believe that it's going to truly be necessary, but if it is, the statutes and the inherent power of this court provide clear alternatives to do it. We have 4 months to undertake that job. Sometime before June, we are going to have to get to a conclusion. And Mr. Williamson's platitudes aside, today, as the pleading indicates, the legislature is at impasse. Somebody must step in. If you do not doubt yourself, as parties know, the federal court will proceed. And that would be wrong as a matter of federalism and wrong for the long-term interests of this state. If this court should take this case, it has the ability to take this case. It has never in 110 years turned down a petition for original action on legislative redistricting. Thank you.
Chief, may I ask a question?
Justice Bradley.
Thank you. Counsel, you'd suggested in your earlier remarks the possibility of this court doing as it did years ago and deciding this case by rulemaking. And reading the transcript from the federal court, you make moment of the need to have your expert, Professor Grothman, present in order to testify. Would you anticipate offering expert testimony if we had a rulemaking, some kind of a rulemaking procedure, or don't you need expert testimony before the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
We do not need expert testimony if the matter is handled as it was in Reynolds or in Dreyfus. However, if the matter is handled as a rulemaking process or other process, I would expect that we would present people like Professor Grothman and others to present information, as I would think other bodies would as well.
Do you think the court needs its own expert witnesses?
I think that it will need the technical assistance of the Legislative Reference Bureau, that just as it did in the Reynolds case in 1964. I think just as the federal court has indicated, the Legislative Reference Bureau provides impartial, nonpartisan advice, and I think that they certainly can provide that kind of analysis that the court might need.
Do you think that we could set up at least, I'll just pick a number, 10 plans, all of which would fit the federal guidelines and would fit the Wisconsin state guidelines?
Let us say that they would satisfy the state guidelines and then the federal guidelines, but yes.
Well, I always thought that behind us was the federal constitution and that it had a supremacy clause.
Yes.
Okay. So we have to fit both the federal and the state guidelines. Do you think we could have at least 10 such plans?
There are such plans.
Yeah, but I mean, 10 would fit that, 15?
I think the number may well be infinite.
Infinite. Okay. So how does the court make the selection?
It satisfies it as it does in every case. There are many times many answers which are correct, but because this is the final arbiter, it will select among them based on the objective criteria of our Constitution and the policies of this state. And that's how it will come to its conclusion.
So you don't think we're going to need experts who are going to evaluate them for us?
I think this
to help us?
It can, if Your Honor believes that's necessary, certainly. There's no magic to that. Of course, if Your Honor wishes to have experts, and the court does, the parties are more than capable of providing them to the court. And
Who's going to pay for them, counsel?
As in California, I would suggest that this court can, in fact, command the executive branch to pay for it. And that is exactly what the California court has done, is created a set of hearings and conducted its own, as I said, essentially rulemaking process, and ordered the legislature or the governor to pay for it, and has hired experts at the cost of the state. That is a reasonable expense based upon what this court must undertake. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
That concludes our hearing on 0200570OA. Scott R. Jensen versus Wisconsin Elections Board, and the court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when we will have additional oral arguments.